This is a recording of Mike D. from Fresno, California, taped at the 5th Annual NA Picnic in Porterville, California, on Saturday, August 17, 1991. In observance with our 11th tradition stating anonymity at the public level, please keep this tape within the fellowship and observe the anonymity of all NA speakers.
Mike D. from Fresno.
Hi, I'm Mike, and I'm a drug addict from Fresno. I'm nervous. I always get nervous. In fact, when I was new, if I would have been told that one of the things that I would be doing after I get a little bit of time around here was to be driving to out of town and speaking, I don't think I'd have stayed. When I got here, one of my biggest fears, besides getting, shot in the face, was having to stand up in front of people and speak. In fact, I would have, in college, at one time, I was going to give a bomb threat rather than speak. It was my turn, and I figured it would be easier just to call in a bomb threat. It was during the mid-60s, and they freaked out a lot about bomb threats, and so I thought, that's how you get out of speaking. And when I came to Narcotics Anonymous, I had that same fears that public speaking was at the top of the list, and although at times in my sobriety I've had to do a lot of it, it never seems like it gets any easier. The time I worry about it gets less, but it still gets just as intense. And so I'm going to give it my best shot. If you're new, and there was only a couple newcomers, the reason why I'm up here is for you and for me. We're the only two that I come up here for, that I drive, get my car and drive, is for you and for me. And you're supposed to be first, but I think I put myself first. I just had a very close friend with over 9 sobriety start using again. So when I got that call to come up here, although my head's saying, make an excuse, my heart knows that if I want to stay clean, I have to continue to do things like this. Enough with that. I started using drugs at a normal age. They were no big thing at the time. There wasn't a lot of them around, and I had gotten in a lot of trouble before drugs even come into my life. I was very familiar with juvenile court before I ever put one chemical in my body. I had trouble in school. The police knew me by name. The truant officer knew me by name before I took any drugs or alcohol. I'd taken some, but it hadn't gotten to the point where I was getting in trouble with it. And so all my problems I can't blame on drugs and alcohol. It's just stupidity. There's a lot of it. But drugs come along, and I used them, and it was no big deal. And it was in the early 60s, and the penalties for drug abuse or drug use or possession were real severe. And so we were real secret about it, and we were real underground, and it was kind of the excitement of it was there was more excitement to the getting and using and hiding and all that underground activity that come along with it than the actual drugs themselves. I didn't know there was such a big deal about drugs when first time I was taking them. I kept waiting for these real explosive drugs that really made you do all this weird shit, and they never came along. And they never came along at that time. I can assure you, at the end of my drug use, I had seen all the weird shit that drugs do to you. But at that time, I couldn't see what the deal was. And, you know, and they were sending people to prison for stems and seeds. And so we were real secret about it. And, you know, and then all of a sudden, like, and there wasn't many around, and you really had to hunt it down. And we were just these little young punk white kids, and so scorn wasn't was fairly hard for us. And I don't know, we really weren't searching it out. It wasn't like when it would come around, we were ready. And as the drugs started hitting the streets a little bit more prevalent during the mid-60s and whatnot, we were ready. And it never at any time when a drug would come along, a new drug would, you know, because we were inexperienced and unfamiliar with drugs, and when a new one would come along, there never was any question in my mind, well, should I take this or shouldn't I? Or maybe I ought to call a pharmacist and find out what this will do to you. Or maybe I should look up in some type of medical journal to find out what this drug does to me. I never asked many questions, you know. After, you know, three or four uses, three or four different kinds of drugs, the only question I would ask is whether it made you go up or made you go down. You know, that's the only question I ask. You know, and I don't know why I asked that question, because no matter what your response to me was, didn't stop me from taking it. You know, I found out in my early drug use that I enjoyed going down more than going up. But that didn't mean that I didn't spend as much time going up as I did going down. You know, it just, I don't know. It just, it seemed like I was more in control. And plus I had some friends that really got into the going up real intense from the very beginning. And man, I didn't like being around them, man. In fact, I had to get more down just to be around them going up. And it was real different. Then I also found out that I even enjoyed more when I took both of them, you know, at the same time. So my body didn't know whether I was going up or going down. And it was kind of like for a couple of years, it was like I would try to juggle, my high with uppers and downers. And, like I felt in more control or something. I think maybe that took place after I started going to jail a lot. I tried to regain control or something. But I don't know. The drug use got more serious. Like I said in the beginning, it was like I didn't know what the big deal was all about. All of my friends and me, we took drugs, we were less of a problem than when we drank. When we drank, it was really, it got insane. So taking drugs and us starting to go underground was something that kept us out of trouble. Instead of out, you know, wrecking our cars and fighting on the street and whatnot, we consumed our activities to somebody's living room or bedroom or something, and just laid around and did nothing. And, you know, and that went on for a number of years. And, you know, the drug use got a little more serious. The people I ran around with became more serious. The penalties for our activities got more serious. At this point, I started to go to jail a lot, and never for any bank robbery or smuggling or anything like that. It was always nuisance crimes. I was always a penny ante, nuisance to the police. And that doesn't mean I wasn't involved or around a lot of felony activity, but I always got caught for the stupid shit. And it was always usually involved an automobile. It was always an automobile involved. I'd either, you know, hit something with mine, or I ran into yours. And so I started going to jail a lot for that, in and about an automobile. And, you know, I never could find a place where I really felt comfortable or really fed in. You know, I was always en route to someplace else for more drugs or cheaper drugs or more women or a louder rock group or something. I was just en route all the time, and my drug use got more serious at that time. And they talk about the imaginary line and where my drug use became an abuse. And it was no longer any fun for me, and even more so, it was no fun for the people around me, and it seemed like at that point the people that had full time jobs and whatnot, our families or whatnot, you know, started gravitating away from me. You know, if you still held any type of responsibility, you didn't want to be around me. If you still had anything decent in your life, you didn't want to be around me. If you had anything of any value, you didn't want it around me. Or anything that you cared about, you didn't want it around me. Not that I set out to screw things up. It would happen. It would happen. And my group of friends and whatnot started to get smaller and smaller and smaller. And in fact, at this point, it was no longer it was no longer a party atmosphere to the drug use. It was just shooting dope with some road dog, you know, and that's all it was. And someone else that was in crime the way I was, that would have more, you know, it was from the time I woke up in the morning or come to, it was, you know, getting more drugs and doing whatever was necessary to get more drugs. And I usually always had somebody, either male or female, around me that would have ideas when I didn't, and would have motivation when I didn't, drug use got real hard for me. I had to stay motivated. You know, I just wanted to lay down and die somewhere. You know, so you need motivation. And being in a hooked doping, you don't always have motivation. Sometimes when you're, you know, being sick, sometimes can motivate you because you want to get well. But a lot of times you just want to, as years go by, you just want to lay down and die somewhere. You know, so that's how it got. By this time I'd already started to go on, I'd been on a methadone detox and whatnot, and I ran into an old friend, this girl that I knew from years before. In fact, she was one of the first girls that I ever seen shoot dope, and she was an old-time dopey. And I ran into her and she said, "Well, no, I'm not using. I haven't used any stuff for a year or whatever." I don't even remember what words she used, but she said a year or something. And I said, "Jesus, you know, how are you doing that?" And she said, "Now you're expecting me to say that she was involved with Narcotics Anonymous." Well, I haven't gotten to that part yet. She said, "Well, we're traveling with the carnival," and I thought, what a great idea, you know. You know, is there room for me, you know? And she said yes. And I'm here to say that if you're trying to kick a habit and want to clean up, the carnival is the last place that you want to be, you know? You know, and that's how my disease talks to me. You know, even now, after almost 9 years of continuous sobriety, my disease still talks to me the exact same way. That thinking that it did then, I need to clean up. This person says, join the carnival. My head says, the disease says, that's a great idea. There's no drugs or alcohol at the carnival, you know. I'll go do that. That's my head again, reassuring me, the disease telling me what I should do would be the best thing for me, when in fact it is the worst thing that I need to do. The absolute worst thing for me to do. It's the exact same disease that when the phone rings and I pick it up and they say, "Hi Mike, would you come to outside of Porterville and speak?" And my mind says, and I hesitate for a second. The disease is talking to me saying, say no. Because that's what's best for you, is to shield yourself from growth and sobriety. Just the same as it was back then when it was telling me to join the carnival. Same damn disease, same voice, trying to take off with these people in this old truck and rejoin the carnival. And I'd like to report that it got better, but it didn't. You know, it got worse. I really learned how to drink at the carnival. I really got the drinking vodka. I really learned how to drink vodka and white port wine and with the carnival. And that's about the only thing I learned. Vodka and white port wine. And I also found out that I had the ability with the carnival of picking a dope fiend out of a crowd. That I could come rolling into a strange town and not know a soul in that town. In opening day, be able to, when the people started walking down the midway, that I could spot a dope fiend that was holding dope or knew where he could get some real quick. You know, I just had that ability to cling to them, whether they wanted me to or not. You know, I was able just to zero in on them, and you know, and then stop from them getting, they wouldn't be able to get by me. You know, and involve them in my game, that whatever trip that I had there, and you know, and get them hooked up with me and whatnot, and you know, and it was just a matter of 30 minutes to an hour, and they're going to go cop for me when I only have to leave. And I found out that I had that ability. See, when I left on the carnival, I thought that when I got to a strange town, that I wouldn't be able to score any dope, so I wouldn't be able to use, you know. And I also found out that there was other people with the carnival that were even better at it than I was. If it took me 2 hours, I found out there was people that could do it in an hour. So they had dope the minute we had a little network system set up that we could score in just a matter of minutes. And so anyway, I also got to meet some people that had that occasionally when they were drinking and using, that they talk about recovery, or their attempts at it, and that was different for me. I had up until this point, I'd been exposed to the program to the point that the only exposure I had is that I had a family member that was sober, and that I think I went to one meeting one time to make this person happy. And that's it. My entire exposure to getting clean or whatever up until this point. And but I wasn't that impressed at that meeting about what they were saying or what they were doing, and it didn't impress me that much. The only thing that I do remember about it was that I knew that I was headed there. That I knew that I was going to end up there someday. That I didn't know when, but I was going to be back there. Whether I liked it or not, that I was going to be back. But I figured it was many, many years away. And the concept of all this was real different to me. And so the carnival thing, they have a thing where they call winter quarters at the end. It's like a place where they park it and like there's a couple months where they just don't do anything. They repaint all the equipment and whatnot, and they call it winter quarters. And they were going to winter quarters in this town, I had no idea where this town was. I had no idea where I was, put it that way. It wouldn't have done me any good to know where the town was, because Mike didn't know where he was. So it wouldn't have done me any good. But I remember knowing that it was over, that I was tired, that it was over, and that I needed some type of medical help because the money was had run out. I didn't know where I was, and in a matter of 24 hours that I was going to start detoxing off of the stuff that I'd been taking, and I knew that that the detox would be worse than anything that I'd ever experienced before, just done because of the amount of drugs and alcohol that I'd been drinking for this period. I knew that it would probably be a good idea that I was around people that were familiar with somebody detoxing, or I probably needed to be in a medical facility, because I had no idea what my body and mind was going to start doing when the stuff started flushing out of my system, and I was scared. Years prior to that, there was times that I was forced to be clean, either through jail or whatever, for a few days, and here I was faced with it again, and knew that it was going to be worse than I'd ever remembered. Because it had been a long time this time since I'd been clean. And so I started asking questions, and I started asking people around there, some of these guys that had talked about where they'd gotten this, they knew about getting clean or whatever the hell they were talking about. And a guy gave me a phone number of a place, and so I called, and it was the wrong number, and but the number he gave, it was like Alamo or something, or something he talked about. And so I looked up enough, I called up the operator, and she the best she could do for me was the Alano, or this Alano Club or something, and it was in this in this town called Fontana. And I thought, where in the fuck is Fontana? And she asked me where I was, operator. And I said, you know, and so she said, well, is there a street around, you know? And there was like, you know, from here to the end of this thing, there was a street sign. She said, set the phone down, walk over, read the sign, come back and tell me. I was almost in my mid-30s by this time, and an operator's telling me how to go out and read a stop sign and come back. On the walk back to the phone, I was kind of having one of those moments of clarity, like, Jesus Christ, Mike, you do need some help here. I tell her the sign, and when she says, just wait right there. A taxi cab shows up. She says, get in. I get in. They take me to this Alano Club, and there was a meeting going on, and the next thing I knew, the meeting's over with, and they stick me in the back of this car and take me to this guy's trailer, and he says, well, we're going to find a place for you tomorrow. This stuff was happening like this. There's somebody holding my fucking arm the entire time, and they don't want me to get away. And I get this feeling that these people are staying close to me, you know. The next thing I know, that he drives me out to Riverside or whatever, and shows me this place where they cut their hair all weird and they had to do all these real weird stuff and I thought, this guy's not going to leave me here, is he? You know, it looked like a big monastery, and these people wore funny clothes and stuff. And he says, no, this won't be any good for you. And then he took me to someplace else, and then all of a sudden he made a call, and this guy come and picked me up, and with those Hondas that just come out, the little ones, and they stuck me in the back seat of this thing, and he says, I'm going to take you to a treatment facility. And he gave me his card, and he was a parole officer for the Riverside County. How I got hooked up with a parole officer, I wasn't on parole, you know, but this guy drove me out in the middle of nowhere and wouldn't let me get out of the back seat of this car. And it wasn't the most, you know, at the time, you know, I'm 6'2", 6'3", and I, at the time, weighed about, 140 pounds. And, you know, my knees are sticking out both back windows of this little teeny Honda car. And this guy's driving along, you know, put me in the back seat. And, at this place, I was around people that walked and talked this program. And it was my first attempt at recovery. And it wouldn't be my last. I started to hear things that I'd never heard before. I started to hear a whole lot of talk. That disease voice that talks to me, that one that tells me that joining the carnival would be a good thing for recovery and da 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 and this and that. That the stuff that tells me just the opposite of what I need to hear. Well, at this place, they started feeding me all sorts of this information. It was the exact opposite of everything that I thought to be true about life. All the knowledge that I had picked up or figured out by the time I'd gotten to this age of my life, what they were talking about at this place was the exact opposite of the way I'd thought my entire life. And they wouldn't allow me to talk this. The guys that were there and whatnot that didn't have any more, I noticed that people started thinking this way very quickly. That if you made some type of a statement that was counter to their way of thinking, they were on you. They were on you. They would not allow you to think dope fiend thinking, you know, and all that goes along with that. And it was you almost like you're pressured to either like start thinking like them or leave, you know, or better yet, if you don't want to think that way, it gets so stressful that you need a drink or something. And but for the first time in my life, I experienced some type of sobriety and was around a lot of real caring people. In fact, it had been so long since I'd been around people that cared about me as much as these people, and they had just met me. They had just met me. And I was real impressed by this thing. And I was real impressed. And the one thing that I did do, that was in 1976 that I entered that place, is that I never drank again after that point. There wasn't any Narcotics Anonymous around there. There was no talk about being clean and sober. It was just being sober. And as far as I was concerned, sober just talked about alcohol, so I just won't drink and everything will be fine. Things did improve. You take alcohol out of my system, I'm only about 98% is screwed up. So it was an improvement for me not to drink, but to continue to use. It wasn't time at all, and I was back in Fresno, sober and hooked, and on methadone and sober. I was a secretary of a meeting, sober and on methadone. There was even people that had a lot of time that it was aware of. I didn't even have to keep it a secret, and they say, "Well, that's okay, Mike. You know, you know, you're doing a lot better." Like they didn't want to rock the boat, you know, or something. They didn't want to say. Because I guess, you know, they just figured that I would get the rest of the message as long as I stuck around, even though the message would get through 70 milligrams of methadone one way or another or something. Now, let's don't say anything to piss him off and then have him split on it. You know, at least, he's an improvement, you know. On the methadone, I was controllable and... you stick a little white port wine in with that, and man, I lose all control. So I guess they weren't trying to rock the boat. I don't know what they were doing. But anyway, I was here. I knew I was here. I had been exposed to enough other treatment facilities and whatnot, and to know that that this is the only place that I ever seen recovery on the street. I'd been in other places that I just couldn't buy into the whole ball of wax, and plus they didn't have any people wandering around on the street that were staying clean. So this was the only, I knew I was here, and occasionally there'd be somebody coming through town that would be coming through Fresno, and they'd start talking about being clean and sober, and it'd make the hair on the back of my neck stand up, like, Jesus, who is this person? You know, it's like, I'm not so sure that they should talk like that around this program. It really made me uncomfortable, and I didn't believe that I could that I had the ability to function on the street without some type of chemical in my system. I just didn't believe it. I just didn't. There wasn't anybody around that I was in my community that I was seeing do it, and so I didn't believe it. And you know, about this time they start an NA meeting up, and I'd go there, and there'd be like one person sitting in there, and I'd think, no, this is not for me, and I'd split, and because I'd reappear about every 6 to 9 months. You know, my drug use would get so far out of control that I'd need to make a pass back by through the meetings and whatnot, and the reason why the part of this my story is that I like to talk about the most, but it's probably, you know, my head tells me, well, that's counterproductive for the newcomer to hear about this all this in and out of you doing, Mike. But I think it's important for the newcomer that's sitting there that has come in and out and in and out and in and out. I see it happen. People get lost in this circle of 30, 60 days or 3 days or whatever, and back out and back in and back out and back in. And it seems like they get lost in that cycle. And as you're involved in that cycle, the people with any time, we kind of back up from them. Because it's scary. You know, I don't want to be around somebody that's got, you know, they might have drugs on them right now. You know, I don't want to go to their house. They might, you know, I don't know. It's just that for people, so I talk about this part of my sobriety, or recovery, for the person that's sitting there, just never give up. I mean, you can't go back out there too many times. That there's still hope, no matter how many times. Or, you know, if you're sitting here loaded right now, if you've never been to an NA meeting clean, there's still hope. You know, it's the more times you go back out, the hope gets dimmer, but there's still hope. There's never it's never too late. And so that's why I talk about this part of my sobriety, about going to meetings loaded and whatnot for a long, long, long time. And you know, it got to the point where I knew that when I would show up to a meeting that what they were saying was, oh, here comes that goddamn Mike again, loaded again, you know? God damn, can't you get this? You know, this is a simple program, Mike. Why don't you wise up and get it, man? You know? I knew that they were saying that about me, you know? The meeting would be over and no one would come up to me. It was just although, you know, my motives, I was getting more serious, they could care less. Mike, show us some action. We don't want to hear any more about your goddamn motives. Show us some actions. And come in and out. And I went out of town. I needed some treatment myself. And my problem was, I thought, was that I needed to go for long psychiatric help. And, like, I needed to go to a state hospital and get some... some type of drug treatment that I'd never had before, or some shock treatment or something. And after a couple of years of that, of them straightening my thinking out, then I could come here and get clean. You know, I had bigger problems than the drugs. You know, the drugs were helping me through my big problems. you know. I needed the drugs to handle these big problems, so why should I can't stop taking these because, but you know, although my drug problem is big, it's not as big as these problems that's going to jump out and get me if I stop taking them. And that was my thinking. And so I went off to this facility again. It was, in fact, I didn't make it there the first time. I was asking Mary the name of this place in Visalia, Pine Manor or whatever it was. I got directed there from Fresno. I made it to Visalia, and I can remember Hiva Coleman taking me over to Pine Manor. And wanting to detox me. I was on my way to North Hollywood to get into a facility, and here I'm in. I can't even make it to Hollywood. I'm in Visalia, they could see that I wasn't drinking, but that I was screwed up. And at the time, the facility just concentrated on alcohol. Maybe they still do. I don't know, but. They were real nice to me. They had a detox unit out and back. They stuck me in there, and they seen after a couple of days in there that I was more screwed up than when I got there, and so they knew that I didn't smell like alcohol, that I had some drugs on me somewhere, stashed somewhere, and I was taking them, and I was. So they ran me on out of there, and I ended up in Bakersfield, still not able to get over that grapevine yet, and. Ended up in a facility in Bakersfield, I was in this facility for a couple days, I think a little bit longer than that, maybe a couple weeks. And one of my first little duties that I could see that they were going to give me was it was like an old converted hospital, and out in this front office there was a telephone ring and whatnot, and they said, "Set this desk here, Mike, and if the phone rings, answer it and say the name of this facility, and then come and get one of us. Don't say anything else, you know, but just answer it." They had to go down in the basement and do some stuff, and so I'm sitting back in this chair, leaning back and put my feet up, and the sun's shining through the window, and thinking, "Man, oh man, this is pretty nice. This also was a co-ed treatment facility. First one of those I'd ever been into, and I thought, man, this is nice. You know, there's girls around here, and you know, and they let me answer the phone, and then I'm looking up at the wall at the licensings and whatnot that they have for this facility. They were actually nice to me here. I don't know why. They were just treating me real nice, and the licensing had on it for mentally disturbed adults was for the license. Mentally, and I got a new perspective on myself at that moment. Those moments of clarity that come to you, and it was like, this must be a goddamn nut house or something, you know. It was more than that, but that was their focus at this place. I was able to come out of that place with a habit after 9 months. And I come back to Fresno one more time, knowing that the only alternative that I had was Narcotics Anonymous. By this time, I'd been in the treatments. I'd been in the, you know, treatment centers all up and down the state. I'd been on methadone so many times I couldn't count. I'd been to psychiatrists and psychologists and family doctors and priests and ministers and whatnot. And I knew that the only hope I had was Narcotics Anonymous. And that I came back to Fresno, and by this time they had a regular meeting, and I walked into this meeting thinking that with the same concept and that same voice telling me, "You ain't gonna make it. There's no one here that understands." Da 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 da. You know, na 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 na. And I walk in there, and there's like a dozen people sitting in this room. There's people that I'd used drugs with on the street, sitting in this room, that had you know, close to a year's sobriety. You know, and I was astounded by. In fact, this one guy, I always just. One of my problems that when coming to meetings, no matter where it was at, was that I always felt that I was worse than anybody else here. I never felt like anybody was like, you guys are too sick for me. I always figured that I was too sick for you. That there was never people that were as slimy as me, or these people just aren't, they just aren't as bad as I was my excuse. And here was such one guy with almost a year sobriety that was one of them few people that I knew out on the street that I thought was worse than I was. Like, Jesus, how much time you got, And so, it was kind of like, this guy's got something going here, and I need to stick around here and find out, what it is. I don't know. He had a car. His wife was, smiling and hugging him and whatnot. I couldn't believe that. He had these little kids that had clean clothes on and everything. And it was, to say the least, I was real impressed that this guy had found some sobriety. I was real impressed. And, although at this point I wasn't sure that this was available to me, I was impressed with him and, how he was doing it. And we only had one meeting then, and so we went to a lot of other meetings, and we went in groups, and we met and stuff, and then all of a sudden we got another meeting and another meeting, and pretty soon we had 3 or 4 meetings a week, and pretty soon I got 30 days. I can't believe it. I got 30 days off of everything. Nothing. I'm not taking anything. And I kind of thought that fear that I'd had all my life, that I had serious mental problems and whatnot, and that I figured before I got 30 days that I would just explode or something would happen. I would have an epileptic seizure or a mental breakdown. I would take my clothes off and run down the street, or I don't know what I was going to do, but I knew something was going to happen. That my body did not have the ability to function without something in its system. And at the end of 30 days, nothing had happened. It'd come close a couple of times. I assure you. It'd come awful close a few times. But it didn't happen. And so I had like 30 days of evidence to hold on to that nothing more serious was going to happen to me. That as bad as I felt and the anxiety and depression that I'd been going through and stuff like that, is this a small possibility that might be as bad as it gets? And I was able to handle that. That if that's as bad as it gets, this maybe I can, stick around here for a while. And it got tense at times. Luckily, I had met somebody through the years of bouncing in and out and stuff. It was this woman that I had a lot of respect for that had many, many years of sobriety, and she was also a clinical psychologist. And so a lot of times I would go to her, and there was even one time that I was going to have him check me in. I had about 2 weeks, and something was taking place inside me, and I didn't know what it was, and I thought maybe I'd be the best thing for me to be was being a nut house when this took place, locked up. So I'd go out to talk to her and through this detox that I was going through. And so I remember that we had a camp out and it was real late one night, and there was people talking about sobriety and like that, and somebody turned to me and said, "Mike, you've almost got a year, don't you?" And I thought, and for the first time in my life, it was my first time, I think I had about 9 months, almost 10 months, that occurred to me, I almost do have a year. Maybe I can make this. Now not only do I have 30 days that I had this 30 days of evidence in my back pocket that nothing worse was going to happen, that this game called life, I did have the ability to cope with life with tools that I had around here and the people that I met, that I was going to have a year. It was almost hard for my brain. It almost went into an overload seizure aspect when I talked about having a year. I wasn't capable of thinking about, Mike's going to have a year. it just was hard for me to concept. Like my name and a year just didn't fit together. It just didn't fit together. And I got a year, and it was it was remarkable to me, and it was also at a year. It came about that that you stick around here. That I was going to have to work some of these steps as hard or harder than anybody who ever walked here before me. That it was going to take that it was really going to take some work in some areas of my life. And a hard thing for me to do in the beginning was to ask another man to be my sponsor. I had this older woman that I could have asked. But I had friends going, nah, Mike, so to walk up to another male and ask him to be my sponsor was real hard. It was real hard. And, I finally did it. And opened myself to this guy, telling him that I'm here to work these steps in my life. That, that I want, no matter what's going to happen, let's do it. Let's get it over with. And let's, by this time, at almost a year, I didn't want to. I'd invested too much time in this thing to start using again. I'd walked through a lot of stuff that I just didn't want to start using again over. And he set me on this path. And in one of the first projects he set me on was on this written fourth step. And I wasn't looking forward to this at all. I really didn't know how to do a four step, but I'd heard people complaining about it for years. And so I knew that if they're going to complain, then I need to complain, and they were complaining for a reason, and so I would have the same reason as they would, But I filtered a lot of that out. I'd invested too much into this deal. To get loaded over it. And I knew that it was going to take some work on my part. And, I did this written four step, and, it was one of those things that, I was having such a bad day that, my mind would tell me, it'd be better, Mike, if you either got loaded or shoot yourself, or once you ride on that four step some more. So I would drag. I kept this thing locked in the trunk of my car, underneath the spare tire, and I had these visions of getting in this automobile accident, and my trunk getting knocked open, and then my footsteps sliding out on the street, and people picking it up and reading it, and a whole community of people standing around laughing, ha 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 ha, pointing at me and pointing at this footstep, and just having the whole community having a laugh on Mike, and over this four step, and it never happened. I was able to finish that four step, and then with that come taking a fifth step, and which was also a difficult task for me, and to unveil the stuff that I'd written. I didn't even like reading about some of this. I didn't even like opening this four step up and reading this stuff, let alone reading it to somebody else. It was uncomfortable for me to even to put this stuff down on paper, or let alone, because I knew putting it down, I wasn't stupid enough to know that when you put it down, that you weren't eventually the fifth step. They say, well, don't think of the fifth step, when you're doing your course. Well, you have to be an idiot not to, and so putting this stuff down, I knew that I was going to have to read it to somebody, and to my sponsor, in fact. And this made me feel uncomfortable. And eventually it took place. It took place. And it was probably one of the things that is no big deal. It was like, after the fourth and fifth roll, I thought, what in the hell is all this shit about on this stuff, man? It was like I couldn't believe what all this stuff... That's one of the things when I hear people talking about when they say, "Well, I got to do my fourth," and they say, "That's one of the first things I'll say is bullshit." That's bullshit. The pain of not doing it is far more severe than the pain of going through it. It's that same diseased voice, you know, talking that shit. And, in fact, since I've done that, in the years following now, there isn't anything on that fourth step that I haven't talked openly at meetings about. You know, there was a time that I didn't even want, you know, a minister to see this stuff. And since then, I've talked about all of it openly at meetings. You know, that I've disclosed it all. I don't want any more secrets. I don't keep any more secrets. And I don't want any more inside of me. It's just not worth it. You know, people talk about you're only as sick as your secrets. And I believe that. And I believe that if you're clean and sober, and you are keeping some secrets that you will eventually drink or use if you don't disclose them. I just don't think that our human body is set up to go that long without hiding the pain in some way, without disclosing it. Because God didn't build this body to keep secrets about shit that I want to talk about that, you know. And that's just my own personal belief. You know. Since then, still, I've continued to work the steps, 6, 7, 8, 9. 8 and 9 were real hard. You know, when you're a dope fiend and you've been stealing and ripping from people for years and years and years and years, you know, where in the hell do you even start on a goddamn list, you know? I'm not financially capable or ever will be capable of cleaning up all the wreckage. But what I do is I start. And I start taking care of the ones that are around me, family and friends, the ones that I can start with. I can knock those out of the way. And it takes time to knock them away because some of the times the money's vast numbers and whatnot. But I had to, start taking care of them. And, I have one that there was a, I have an old dope fiend friend that I ripped off right before I came to the program, and it's a lousy $50. And this guy owns me. You know, next month I'll have 9 years of continuous sobriety. This guy still owns me. I haven't seen him. You know, he's not in the phone book. You know, but I'm waiting to see him. You know, in fact, for many years, I carried around a $50 bill with his name on it, with a little piece of paper with a clip on it, with his name on it. So I would always have that $50 on me. So when I see him, I could walk just directly up to him and hand it to him. You know, I carried that $50 and that piece of paper for so long, the name was gone, the $50 bills, the ink on one side of it from getting wet so many times was almost white and whatnot, but I'm still looking for him. You know, I'm still looking for him. When I think of my past, I think of this guy. I did a lot of things when I was drinking and using, that never really bothered me until I got clean. You know, there was a lot of things that at a year or two, I thought, oh my God, you know, I would drive down the street and see a house or see somebody or see a brand of a television set, or I would see something that would trigger these thoughts of people that I had done harm to or wrong to, and it would just eat at me, you know, pain had come to me, like, oh no, you know. It's important to clean up that wreckage. I'm still doing it on a continuous basis. What I've also got to find out is it's even just as important is not to create any new stuff. It's not to create any new stuff. That starts getting real easy after you start getting, you know, better jobs and start making more money and getting credit reestablished and credit cards and new obsessions start taking over I'm going to buy this and I'm going to buy that and I'm going to get that. I've went off on tangents on every possible thing that there is. The only the one I haven't talked about, and I'm not going to brag, but it's been gambling. I've stayed away from gambling. Like, I have friends that have just went nuts on gambling with a lot of years. And but I went off on these weirdest little tangents where it's just like there was this one of the early ones that I went off on, these obsessions, was on shoes. It's real weird. I started buying all these shoes, these real nice shoes and stuff, and until I had a whole closet full of shoes, all these shoes, and I couldn't walk by a shoe store without going, you know, picking out the pair that I would like to have. It was real weird. It was chasing these obsessions. There's nothing wrong with it. I see nothing wrong with it. Especially, I mean, you're not going to end up in jail for buying too many shoes, but or wearing too many. You only wear two at a time anyway. But these obsessions have become a lot of fun for me. You know, what's Mike on now? You know, what's he chasing now? It's like I'll get an item, and then I'll go and the chase of the item and the buying of it only lasts for about 48 hours. And then it's like I got to look for something new, you know, that I'm going to buy. And this item can either cost $5, you know, or $100,000. It doesn't matter. The obsession inside me is the same. I chase it with, you know, with the same amount of diligence that I would the bag. And it's been a lot of fun. You know what? What Narcotics Anonymous has given me is given me more friends than I ever believed was possible for Mike to have. Narcotics Anonymous has given me the ability to wake up in the morning and not have all these anxiety attacks and depression and stuff on me. You know, I feel good when I wake up in the morning. I feel good almost every goddamn morning I wake up. Almost every morning I wake up, I feel good. You know, it's like I want to greet, you know, I'm waiting for the paper boy to come. I want to read the newspaper. You know, most of the time I'm attacking the day. You know, let's go, come on. And, man, I wasn't like that when I got here. My activity schedule, the things I get invited to and asked to participate in, and the amount of friends that I have is astronomical. You know, I have to keep a date book with events and stuff that are taking place in my life and weddings and whatnot. I have to keep them right in places I'm supposed to be at this time and that time, and I have to keep it all written down because my life is so full that it has to be written down and kept track of for me. And a lot of times when people will call me, or I'll get an invitation, or something will happen, or I get asked to do something, I have to go check this book to see that I don't have something going on already on this day. And I didn't have that when I got here. You know, I wasn't, I didn't need to keep a date book on the places I was going to have to be at when I got here. I'll tell you, you know, I had absolutely zero friends when I got here. I wasn't being invited anywhere. And, you know, and my life is real good and full today. And, you know, I the amount of, one of the things that has really surprised me is if you stick around here for a while, that people start putting value on what your opinion is or what you have to say. Not only here at meetings and whatnot, but on the outside world. That people start looking up to you. You take a Dolphine who's been around the block, and you put a little God in his life, and you put a little sobriety in his life, and people start looking up to you. People are impressed. I can be around some real important people, and there's people talking to me over them. It astounds me at the attention that I get sometimes. And how people will seek me out to talk to me about
people will call me and ask me questions about shit that I don't have the foggiest idea of what I should tell them or the answer I should give them or what the hell. You know, my biggest answer to give to somebody is, have you prayed about it? Because before I give you an answer, I'm going to have to pray about it, you know. I have people calling me and asking me to do things totally outside the program, but whatever, you know, about, I got called the other day from a relative that I guess has an awful lot of money and who, she needs an executor of her will. And she was going to put me down, but she wanted to call me and ask me first. That her attorney told her that it wasn't necessary, but she wanted to let me know first that she was putting me down as an executor of her will. And I don't even know what the hell an executor of a will is supposed to do, you know. And this woman told me, you know, Mike, I'm not a poor lady. And I thought, Jesus, you know, at now this woman, you know, is 70 years old. She's lived a real full life. She's met thousands and thousands of people her whole lifetime. She's had very responsible jobs her entire life and been around some very important people in her life. And at the tail end of her life, who did she decide to call to be the executor of her will? Me. That blows my mind. That I'm put in that position. That, you know, it's just like, you know, I don't know whether I'm supposed to be proud or nervous or I should find out, you know, what the, you know, am I going to be responsible in case, like there's lawsuits against, you know, I don't know, you know. I'm going to have to find out more about this. But it just really impressed me. When she asked me, and, you know, I felt a warm glow come over me that it's happened many times in this program that I know that God's working in my life, that God is doing for me what I don't have the ability to do, that her doing that to me, things like that, and many times have happened. And a lot of times it's real small stuff. It's the real small stuff that affects me the most when people ask me this or that or whatever goes on. It really impresses me, and that the respect that I get around here, it amazes me. If you're new, and this is your first meeting, your fifth, if you're sitting here loaded right now, keep coming back. Keep coming back. There's always hope. If people are going, oh shit, here he comes, when you show up at meetings, keep coming back. There's room for you. There's room for you. It's never too late. God's love is abundant. He never runs out. There's enough of it for you. Accepting God's love doesn't make you a sissy or a punk. I have sensed a lot of the people that I was trying to protect my image of when I got here are dead now anyway. So, if you got people that you're gonna think less of you for being here, they're probably going to die any day anyway. You know, just keep coming back. Narcotics Anonymous works, and I'm living proof of it. Thank you.